It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, as the Ebola outbreak recedes in West Africa, a local disease expert shares some lessons we can learn for future outbreaks.
First, more and more crude oil is making its way through Wisconsin by rail, and it's prompting discussions over safety and at least one legal challenge over proposed rail expansion.
And after a recent oil train derailment just outside of Wisconsin in Galena, Illinois, two Wisconsin politicians are calling on the Obama administration to finalize new rules on oil train car safety, something the U.S. Department of Transportation was scheduled to have done earlier this year.
Joining us now to talk more about the latest oil train news is Mike Ivey. He's a business reporter at the Capital Times in Madison. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, Mike, first, how much oil train traffic are we seeing here in Wisconsin?
Well, I was really surprised. I think, like a lot of people, you hear about some of these derailments and crashes, but then when they had the derailment last week in Illinois, I took a look at a little further, and there are about 40 trains per month coming through the state now carrying oil, largely from North Dakota. And most of these trains have about 100 cars on them. So think of 40 trains coming through. That's a little more than one a day. And they can be up to 100 cars long. Each car carries about 63,000 gallons of oil, if I'm reading this right, some of the big new ones. So that's a lot of oil moving through here.
So we're talking about 40 trains coming through Wisconsin per week. Is there an indication?
No, not per month.
Per month,
yeah.
Rather. Sorry, thanks for the correction. Yeah. And that, is there any indication that that number is on the
way
increase?
Up? There, from all I can gather, there was almost no trains with oil moving through here prior to 2008. Nationally, the figures I've got is there about 415,000 a year now moving through the U.S., and that's up from about 9,000 just back in 08, you know, when a lot of the oil started coming from North Dakota via, you know, the hydraulic fracturing that they're doing there. So it's, I don't see any slowing of it, basically.
Now, derailments like the one near Galena seem to be at the top of people's concern list. Do you have a sense of how frequently derailments like that happen, both inside Wisconsin and outside?
There's not been one yet in Wisconsin, as far as I know. We've had some pipelines go, but not the oil cars crashing. But I did see that there were three in Canada last week. They've got a lot of traffic coming through there. That was in Ontario. Of course, there was the highly publicized derailment in Canada last year that killed dozens of people. I don't have the exact number, but that was all pretty bad. The problem is when you do have a crash, often the oil catches fire, and you know you have that fire combined with the environmental damage of this oil spilling out. And the other thing is that railroad lines often run through, they follow river beds. If you think of how all the train traffic that comes down that Mississippi River and follows those old riverways, then you end up with the environmental problems when you have a spill. The crash in Galena was right where the Galena River flows into the Mississippi. So,
And speaking of the environment, mm-hmm. The Department of Natural Resources is facing a legal challenge currently regarding a recent permitting decision that could pave the way for a new set of rail tracks through the La Crosse Marsh. What's happening there?
Well, you have to, you know, if you want to expand the tracks, you have to get the permits to do it. And the DNR, about a year ago, started rewriting what's called Chapter 150. This is basically the law that oversees environmental protections in the state. And they changed the wording in that to, I mean, basically make it easier to get a permit is the best way I can describe it. And the company Burlington Northern in this case had applied for a permit both to fill the wetland and to do a bridge across the La Crosse Marsh. So that all got approved, and I think after this derailment in Galena, a citizens group in La Crosse got together and said, "Hey, let's challenge the department on this reworking of the rules and whether they did enough environmental impact analysis to determine if the project was going to be safe." And they listed a lot of concerns, from bald eagle habitat just to noise on, you know, people living next to the train tracks.
Senator Tammy Baldwin and U.S. Representative Ron Kyne called on the Obama administration this week to take immediate action to address oil train safety. Did they lay out any specific proposals?
Well, there's been some talk. These rules were being bounced around back last summer, and one of the proposals was to just at a minimum require two crew members on a train. I think the old days of a guy in the caboose and a couple of engineers are gone. A lot of railroads have tried to cut costs by having just one crew member on their trains. Now, I did speak with someone from Burlington Northern today, and their trains all do have two crew members. But Senator Baldwin and Ron Kyne, again, I think they were playing off the Galena accident, want to see these rules move forward a little more quickly and get them in place. Because, like we'd said earlier, I don't think there's any slowing of the oil trains. And that's one of the arguments for doing pipelines. At least if there's a problem there, you don't have the train cars tipping over. You just have oil spilling on the ground. So
now, these federal rules that Senator Baldwin and Representative Ron Kyne are calling for, those were due back in January, right?
Yeah, and they, like a lot of things don't move quite as quickly in government as maybe we always wish they would. It seems kind of like a bipartisan thing, but the the rail industry is going to make its pitch for for not being pushed too quickly on this stuff. So I encourage anybody that's interested to go ahead and take a look at our story. I've got a link to their letter and some other stuff on there that I was pretty. But mainly, I was just really surprised to see that there was that many oil trains coming through the state.
And we've talked on this show before about the possibility of changing the structure of the cars, either retrofitting them and also building new ones. Have you seen that and what people are
doing? Yeah, well, actually, an interesting thing is the cars are not actually owned by the railroad. They're owned by the oil companies or whoever's shipping the oil. There have been some improvements in oil tanker technology. For a while, they were almost using milk cars that would transport milk that weren't really set up, but the cars that did crash in Galena actually were the newer variety that are supposedly less prone to rupture if they do tip over. So I don't know if it's hard to build a tank car that doesn't rupture if it tips over, but I think they're trying to work on it. But there's all kind of rules here in the feds are looking at in terms of speed and braking, and then the other thing is it's really hard to get a lot of information on how many trains are going through because it is considered private information that the railroads don't like to give out. So some of it is on file with safety officials, but I think the public is frustrated because they'd like to know what's in these cars.
And going forward, the DNR is going to be up against some budget cuts, some restructuring. Do you see any impact there with their ability to conduct thorough environmental reviews of proposed rail sites?
Well, I haven't heard the rail issue raised. I know the budget talks about getting rid of probably up to a dozen scientists who might be looking at probably more specific environmental impacts. I haven't heard much. In fact, I think the governor and the legislature has been sort of supportive of the rail industry as much as anything. They've had money in the budget for track improvements and have worked to have additional regulators in areas that seem related to either, moving sand specifically, or in this case, I don't know if there's any additional stuff in there with the oil. But for the most part, I think the Walker administration has been tried to be a friend of the fuel industry, which is got a lot more activity here than it certainly did 10 years ago.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
As always, guys, thanks.
That was Mike Ivey, business reporter for the Capital Times.
The rapid rise of Ebola in West Africa quickly created a health crisis in the countries of Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, and raised concerns in neighboring countries and around the world, with media attention picking up here in the United States last fall.
And the story isn't over yet, but the spread of the disease appears to have been contained. Last week, a Liberian clinic released the last known patient with the disease in that nation, and the numbers are way down in other West African countries.
While the disease spread has slowed, two questions remain. What are the long-term consequences of the illness, and what did we learn that could help us in future outbreaks? Tony Goldberg joins us in the studio. He's a professor of epidemiology at the UW-Madison Veterinary School and associate director for research at UW-Madison's Global Health Institute. Tony, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much, Rob.
Well, before we get to lessons learned, I don't want to talk like, in the past tense here with Ebola. Where is the disease still lingering?
So the outbreak is definitely slowing, but there are micro-scale outbreaks still occurring. So isolated cases and local spread, typically in areas that don't have good access to public health infrastructure.
And so is there still ongoing international outreach to those areas and from the countries involved?
There is. There's a sense that we're scaling down a bit and the outbreak has been contained, but we still have international presence and we're still trying to build local capacity.
So for people who had the disease and survived, what are the long-term impacts?
Well, there are physical and psychological impacts. So people are starting to talk about post-Ebola syndrome, which is an interesting constellation of symptoms. About half the people who survive Ebola suffer long-term vision loss, in some case leading even to blindness. So that's a major concern. And for those who survive the disease, they might have persistent headaches, body pain, fatigue, sort of long-term consequences that we don't really understand yet, and also psychological trauma. You know, Ebola, the narrative on Ebola before this outbreak and in the early years or in the early months was that it's a universally fatal, horrible disease. So if you went away from your village diagnosed with Ebola, you were not expected to come back. So for people who did come back, they often found themselves ostracized. Their houses and belongings may have been burned. They may have been accused of being witches for having come back from the dead, things like that. So it's not been an easy homecoming for those lucky enough to survive.
And there were stories even earlier in the outbreak of the stigma you're talking about being associated, even when people had survived and were past the point of contagion. So you're saying that stigma hasn't necessarily gone away.
That's right. It hasn't. It's a scary disease, and Ebola survivors are clearly their families and friends are very happy to see them back, but there's persisting fear. And for those people who don't understand that Ebola is a survivable disease, they're very fearful.
Well, I'm going to get to some of the lessons learned, and I'll start by listening to Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Last month, the BBC asked her about regrets about the way her country dealt with Ebola.
I would have engaged the participation and ownership of the communities at a much earlier stage. We tried containment through a little bit of force and a little bit of changing people's habits by demand and by fiat. We did not do enough with communicating with them on the severity of the disease, our own fears, our own lack of capacity. And so that created a certain amount of distrust as to what we were doing, as to whether we knew what we were doing.
Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf there. Tony, to the first point we heard there, how important is it to engage local people, local communities, and bring them on board as active participants in fighting a disease like Ebola?
It's critical. I don't think anybody at this point would disagree with the president of Liberia. One lesson we learned that I think we're going to have to take to heart is just how wrong we were about the projected number of Ebola cases we thought we'd see. Early in the epidemic, there were really horrible projections of between 1 and 2 million cases we could expect. But the actual number of cases as of today is only about 25,000.
A lot still, but
not to detract from the seriousness of those cases, but nothing like the 1 to 2 million. And one has to ask, why were we so wrong? What did we not take into account? And I think the president's statement speaks to that. We did not take into account the capacity of people to change their behavior and respond to the outbreak. So the initial projections were based on sort of an extension of transmission rates estimated from early in the epidemic, whereas in fact those transmission rates turned out to be much lower because people were changing their behavior.
I think when we hear about a disease like Ebola, there's a certain amount of fatalism. Like, this is going to spread. There's nothing we can do about it. Is this a common thing, though, that people can change behaviors in a fairly short order and nip diseases like this in the bud, no matter how bad they look up front?
That is not an established paradigm. Before this outbreak, I don't think most epidemiologists would have guessed that we would see such dramatic effects of people adapting to this crisis. I think we're going to have to change the way that we project outbreaks into the future. I think we're going to have to put greater attention on the capacity of people at a very local level to take care of themselves and to help in the process. And I think that's the message that the Liberian president got across so well.
And she also said there a thing that she thinks they got wrong. They didn't communicate enough up front. So is she right that transparency and honesty about what the government can do and what it knows and what it can't do and doesn't know, does that really help?
That really does help. If the key to stopping an outbreak is changing the behavior of people at the local level, they need to feel empowered to change their own behavior. If they're receiving mandates from above without clear explanations from people who claim to know what to do when in fact they might not know so well, then there's going to be distrust and sometimes unforeseen consequences.
Well, I think there's sometimes a fear like, well, we don't want to create a panic by saying we don't know these points or we're not in control. Are we overrating the fear of panic as a result of not enough information?
I think we are overrating the fear of panic. I think when people confront crises, they often rise to the occasion. And rather than panic, maybe we should have engaged people more as partners and worked with them rather than trying to tell them what to do.
Now, we've been talking, I think, mostly about what local governments or the national governments in these cases can do. Looking at the international community's response, are there things that could have been done better, that we could do better next time around?
Well, I think speaking to some of the same points, when the initial teams from international organizations came on the ground, there was the emphasis was on constructing these very elaborate Ebola treatment centers and creating centralized hospitals and public health and treatment infrastructures. And that was all necessary, but that may have happened a little bit too much in comparison to some of the local outreach and education efforts. And the other thing, getting back to what we originally talked about that was not anticipated and we're playing catch up with now, is what to do with the survivors. So not only are the people who survived Ebola suffering medical and psychological consequences, but there has been talk that those same people might actually have played a greater role in the treatment of Ebola patients after they recovered. If they're immune, for example, and not able to get the disease, maybe they could be useful in treating patients who are sick. In fact, there's local organizations like the Ebola Survivor Corps that are trying to work on that model of engaging survivors.
Do outside aid providers do enough to bridge cultural gaps? I mean, you think about part of the way this was transmitted was based on local funeral customs of how the deceased are treated and what a crucial part of a culture that was. Do we pay enough attention to how we communicate sensitively that this cherished tradition may be part of the spread of the disease?
That particular practice you mentioned, funeral practices and preparing bodies for burial, was made a big deal of early on. And I think that was only one of many ways that the disease could be transmitted. So if anything, I think a sort of a more holistic view of the way that culture and disease transmission interact would have helped. So the short answer is yes, but it's a nuanced yes, because I think it really encompasses a deeper understanding of a suite of cultural practices.
Mm-hmm. And is this a case where, again, that community involvement, bringing them, consulting with them as part of an international effort, could help with those nuances?
Absolutely. I think that's the only way, really empowering local community leaders and just local people to take charge and provide suggestions that are culturally acceptable and implementable is the best way to tackle these outbreaks.
And I want to bring things home here to the United States. Dr. Craig Spencer, he was one of these international medical workers we've been talking about. He caught Ebola while volunteering there. He became the center of media attention when he came down. He showed symptoms of the disease back home in the U.S. He wrote a recent piece in a medical journal, very critical of the U.S. media, of U.S. politicians for creating a sense of irrational panic over the potential for Ebola here. Do you think our reaction here in the United States could have been done better?
Absolutely. I think one of the most disappointing aspects of Dr. Spencer's experience and the experience of those like him was the ostracization and vilification that he met when he came back. It reminds me a little bit of Vietnam soldiers returning from the war, having done the best in difficult situations, only to find themselves sort of in the middle of a political fight and ostracized by certain segments of our society. So I think that Dr. Spencer and people like him should be commended for what they did and should be embraced as heroes. And yet he very poignantly describes how he found himself being taken advantage of by multiple sides.
Are there things we could do better in future outbreaks around the world to provide information, say, from the CDC, from politicians, from the media, to provide the kind of information we're talking about providing the people in West Africa?
I think so. I think dispelling misconceptions about Ebola and infectious diseases in general is very important. We know now that Ebola is not this universally fatal, horrible, zombie-like disease. It's pretty awful, but it's possible to recover. And if someone has recovered from Ebola, then they're not infectious anymore. And if someone has happened to catch the disease, their transmitting that disease can be prevented with appropriate care.
Briefly, Tony, as we wrap up, are we learning the right lessons, or are we kind of forgetting about them and we're going to be caught by surprise on the next outbreak?
I think it remains to be seen. I think we have learned some lessons, but time will tell whether we've internalized them. We still don't know the natural reservoir for Ebola. We don't know how the first case was transmitted to the first person. So we can expect that Ebola or diseases like it will emerge again. And I think the answer to your question will have to, unfortunately, await the next epidemic.
We'll leave it there for now. Tony, thanks a lot for joining us again. That was Tony Goldberg, professor of epidemiology at the UW-Madison Veterinary School and associate director for research at UW-Madison's Global Health Institute. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. In just a moment, we'll take a look at the ways we're monitored by our employers and how that information gets used.
First, WPR's Gilman Halstead joins us for an update on the ongoing protests over last Friday's police-involved shooting in Madison. Gilman, welcome back.
I'm glad to be here.
So you covered a couple events last night. Let's start with a press conference, I believe, involving Tony Robinson, the 19-year-old Madisonian who died in that police-involved shooting. His family held a press conference.
Right. His family was there. Only his uncle spoke, who has actually flown in from New York and appears to be becoming the spokesperson for the family right now. I think the more immediate family is just too really shaken by what's going on. Although the uncle was brought up in Madison, and he was close with his nephew. He's only 4 years older than him, Turin Carter. And I think the most interesting thing that came out of that news conference, as this national focus on Madison right now is in the media in terms of comparing us to Ferguson or Brooklyn or the other places where we've had police-involved shootings with young black men, was that two things. He wanted to make clear that he didn't condone some of the really anti-police rhetoric that has been being chanted in the streets by a lot of the folks in the community who are understandably very angry about what happened. He made a big point of saying that our family doesn't condone this, that we recognize the necessity for there to be police, that this was the action of one officer. We do hold the police department responsible for what this officer has done, but we don't want to malign all police officers. And he also said that they respect the system that's in place here and that they believe that when the facts come out, that it will be shown that the shooting was unjustified. They feel confident in that, but they want to wait until that investigation comes out. They were not joining cries for firing the police officer immediately, which is what I heard about at another event I went to yesterday.
Yeah, that was, and I heard your reporting on this on Madison's Police and Fire Commission, and there were calls for the firing of that officer from protesters there.
Right. There were about 50 people who jammed into a very small room for what was just a regular open meeting of the Police and Fire Commission. The Robinson shooting was not on the agenda. The Police and Fire Commission are not involved in investigating it. But they are involved with discipline of police officers, and that's one of the reasons that protesters targeted it. And a long line of very angry, mostly African-American members of the community, a lot of women spoke and said it's time for this officer to be fired, and we believe that it is symptomatic of what's been going on in the community. They gave testimonies about how they feel they've been treated unfairly by the police, and the sense that police officers were afraid of young black men, and that that something needed to be done to change the way police were interacting with the community.
And what can we expect next when it comes to this ongoing reaction and protest?
Well, the Young, Gifted, and Black Coalition are holding a demonstration this afternoon at the City-County Building. There will, I'm sure, be talk again about calling for justice for Tony Robinson, but they're going to be focusing a lot on pressuring the county to come up with more alternatives to incarceration to reduce the disparity rate in the prison, which is mostly African Americans. And then there's a big rally planned for tomorrow out at the Department of Corrections focusing on similar issues. That's tomorrow afternoon.
Gilman, we'll watch for your reports on this. Thanks a lot for coming up. That was Gilman Halstead, reporter here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
You may work in an office, a store, a factory, or other job that monitors your online activities. Lots of people do, but how is that information used, and what does it mean for you?
From workplace-sanctioned social networks to tracking keystrokes, our next guest examined how electronic data are collected and its impact on employees in her Harper's cover story, The Spy Who Fired Me.
Esther Kaplan is also the editor of the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. Esther, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, first off, what are the common methods of data collection in the workplace?
Well, there have always been efforts to track workforces and their efficiency. Back in the old days, someone stood by a production line with a stopwatch and, you know, tried to time how long each step along the way took and create process improvements. But what we're seeing in the last 10 years or so is on a whole new level. Electronic monitoring began to pick up speed in the 90s in call centers where computers tracked the number of time that somebody was on a call doing, you know, customer service or whatever it was, and whether they'd reached their quota. In the last 8 to 10 years, with the steep drop in the price of computer processors and storage and radio frequency devices and GPS devices, we now have massive workforce monitoring systems that are scooping in real-time cash register data, say at a retailer, with historical data, with data about each individual employee's scan rate, say at the cash register, and pulling up metrics on each individual worker, on the staffing needs of the operation at any given moment in very small time increments, and the most minute kinds of inefficiencies are being squeezed out of the system. With GPS, the Internet of Things, we have data being scooped up from packages, from vehicles, and all swept into systems that are tracking, say, a driver out in the field or someone moving a package around an Amazon warehouse. So it's just an incredible amount of data that's being collected right now by very large computer systems.
And the companies that provide this kind of service with their software, they say that, you know, for the last 50 years, there hasn't been a revolution in how we've monitored employees in the workplace, and that this represents that new change. What kind of companies are out there doing this, and where has their technology been adopted so far?
Right. Well, as I said, call centers were kind of at the vanguard, especially as call center work was being offshored. There was a desire to monitor what was going on out there. It moved into warehouses. It's been heavily adopted in retail and manufacturing and healthcare. And now we're beginning to see it heavily in transportation and trucking, and also in sectors where you might not expect it as much, knowledge sector jobs, financial services, high-tech, business services, even doctors, nurses, college professors.
I want to zoom in on one aspect of this that you studied. You looked at, you got curious about why your packages were getting delivered to the wrong place and were not being delivered at all. And that's sort of what originally got you going on this, when this was to look at UPS. What have you seen there when you talked to some UPS employees?
Right. So UPS was on the vanguard of one kind of system called telematics. And telematics is pulling in information from vehicles out in the field, everything from information from the computer's own, the vehicle's own computer about the status of the brake pads, each UPS vehicle now has 200 different sensors that can check whether the vehicle is idling, whether it's in reverse, whether the seatbelt is buckled, whether that back bulkhead door is open or shut, and, of course, the location. And then there's this Dyad, the handheld device that UPS drivers carry, and that, too, is sending in more information. So what's happened is as UPS instituted this system over the last 8 years or so, they were able to squeeze out all of these inefficiencies, reduce idling time. There were some fantastic benefits of this, such as reducing the amount of gasoline that was purchased and burned by UPS and increasing efficiency in terms of vehicle repair. But it also really put a lot of pressure on the workforce. You see them over the course of implementation increasing domestic package delivery by 1.5 million packages with 22,000 fewer domestic employees. And when I talk to UPS drivers and labor organizers, I mean, it's just an epidemic of injuries because the stop count for each driver has just gone up and up and up. And the result with, you know, a lot of these systems, once you set a really specific metric that everyone has to meet, people will find the workarounds in order to meet that metric. So drivers buckling their seatbelts behind them because they know that buckle rate is going to be detected, but sitting, you know, on top of it so they can just miss that few seconds of time it takes to unbuckle and rebuckle when they get in and out of their truck, but of course a huge safety disaster. And at the same time, why, when you get near the doorway of a delivery stop, why ring the bell and wait the 3 minutes for someone to come down their staircase and sign for the package when you can just slap that delivery attempt notice at the door?
And another aspect of this is the psychological impact on the employees themselves. What did you find both in UPS and in other fields that you looked at?
Yeah, well, I mean, among drivers who've experienced this telematics implementation, which is just taking off, it's expected to be a $30 billion industry within the next few years, but it's maybe a 20% adoption rate right now. But surveys show that the driver resistance is massive, that 80% of firms who've tried to implement this face intense driver resistance. The academics that I've talked to who've been studying electronic monitoring for some years show that when you're monitored, you experience greater stress, you experience greater repetitive strain injuries, neck injuries, spine injuries, that there's all kinds of these negative effects on the body and also in terms of collegiality, that a relationship between a supervisor and a workforce that might have been positive gets eroded once that workforce realizes that they're being electronically monitored in that way. So there are studies that show very real productivity gains of the type I mentioned with UPS. You're really getting a lot more work out of fewer employees, but there's all of these, I think, unanticipated knock-on effects as well.
We're talking right now with Esther Kaplan about the human cost of workplace monitoring. She writes about that subject in this month's cover story of Harper's Magazine.
And we want to know what you think and how things work where you work. Are you concerned? Are you affected by this kind of workplace data tracking? What has the impact been for you? If you're on the other side of things, the management side of things, what have the benefits been for your company? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Esther Kaplan about digital data collection in the workplace and how it impacts your life on the job.
Does your workplace track your data in some way? Your keystrokes on the computer, the time spent on a call, the route you take to the next delivery? How does it do it? How does it affect your job, your attitude toward your job? Or if you're on the supervisory side of things, how does this help your company? How does it make you more efficient? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Esther, I want to talk a little bit about the impact on people who work remotely. Maybe they work from home or, you know, from a coffee shop, and about a third of the workforce apparently does this. How is this impacting those people?
Well, just before I get to that, I did want to say, because you were asking listeners whether they're being monitored on the job, that, you know, there are no federal laws requiring companies to disclose that they're monitoring you, and only two states have laws that regulate this in any way, and Wisconsin is not one of them. So many of your listeners may be being monitored, even though they don't know. But yeah, the remote worker, the teleworker, the telecommuter is kind of one of the vanguards of this. More and more workers are working remotely, often taking a company computer home. Your firm can then monitor everything you're doing. I mean, they can actually look at your desktop as you're working and see exactly what you're doing. They can certainly check what websites you're visiting, who you're emailing, who you're instant messaging. They could tally your keystrokes, your mouse clicks. It's all available to them if you're on the company computer. What I found striking is that in the realm of freelance and contract work, there are now these quite large freelance marketplaces online, Elance, Odesk, where people find work through these platforms. And in those cases, they ask you to log into an interface so that the client who hires you for transcription work or coding work or graphic design work or whatever it is can track your work even on your personal computer in your home. So I actually tried it out. I hired out for some transcription work through Odesk, and it was kind of incredible. I actually, every 10 minutes, I got a screenshot of this woman I'd never met living in Texas. I got a screenshot of her computer, and for minute by minute, I got a tally of her keystrokes and her mouse clicks. And I could just watch this transcription unfold on this other person's personal computer as I clicked through these monitoring windows. So it was quite an eerie experience.
And going back to what you were saying about regulations, about whether people would actually know if they were being monitored by their employers or not, how would people find out? If they wanted to know, could they simply go to their employer and say, hey, are you using any of this metric tracking, or would it come out in an evaluation, say?
Well, this kind of monitoring is increasingly being used in evaluations, absolutely. In the knowledge worker field, people like you and I, it's now considered very important that knowledge and knowledge sharing are considered assets. So a company might track how often I communicate with people in other departments, how often I share documents or share PowerPoints. You know, all of that is trackable and feeding into promotions, raises, assessments, absolutely. Can you know? It's totally at the discretion of your employer. I think best practice is absolutely considered that an employer should notify the employees of all monitoring that's going on. Labor law attorneys would advise a company to do that, but there is no requirement whatsoever for them to tell you if they're monitoring or how they're monitoring or what they're monitoring, unless you happen to live in Connecticut or Delaware.
And about what percentage of businesses, companies, anybody uses this?
Well, you know, I think it's become so ubiquitous that it's not even being tracked anymore. The American Management Association used to do a very large survey of corporate environments every few years to see how many companies were tracking what. Their most recent survey was from 2008, and which is, you know, ancient in technology years, right? And in 2008, two-thirds of employers were monitoring their employees' internet use, and almost half were tracking keystrokes and monitoring employee email. One can only imagine what those numbers look like today.
Let's get in a caller quickly here. Matt is joining us in Menominee Falls. Matt, hi.
Hi. The reason I was calling is you know, we're talking about all this technology, and I'm kind of wondering if there's employees that, I guess, would have that same ability, you know, if they have cell phones that do video recording or audio or picture taking. Is there kind of a employee situation that...
Okay, interesting question, Matt. So can you turn the tables, Esther?
That's a really good question. I think at that point the laws regulating you would just relate to what a private citizen can do, and there are regulations state by state about whether you can you need two-party consent or one-party consent to record audio. That kind of thing depends state by state. You know, it's interesting, in all the reporting I did, I never quite heard about employees trying to monitor back, but it doesn't seem impossible that that's going on.
And Esther, just briefly, as we wrap up here, what do you see as the future of this kind of moneyball approach to employment?
Well, it's definitely the trend. I think there's a feeling, you take a field like telematics, the vehicle, Internet of Things part of it, and there's just a sense that, you know, you have to keep up with the Joneses. And if other firms are doing this, partly because of consumer demands are driving part of that. Consumers want to know exactly how many blocks away their delivery truck is and exactly when that delivery is going to come. And those expectations get pushed right onto the employees in terms of the level of monitoring. I don't see anything reversing the rapid adoption of this right now.
Esther, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it was great to be with you.
We've been speaking with Esther Kaplan, editor of the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, and she's the author of the current Harper's cover story, The Spy Who Fired Me.
Sad news this week for fans of The Simpsons, like me. Co-creator Sam Simon passed away yesterday at the age of 59. A TV writer for shows like Cheers and Taxi, he was there from the beginning of The Simpsons when it became a half-hour show in the late 80s.
Well, he left the show after four seasons. There seems to be agreement from people involved with The Simpsons that he was a big part of the show's continued existence over a quarter century after it started.
One writer tweeted that a key lesson from Simon was, love your characters. And The Simpsons created a huge cast of Springfield residents and endless quotes. Here's a favorite of mine from local mobster Fat Tony.
I am not so much disappointed as I am blinded with rage.
It's surprising how often that one is useful in my life. I don't know.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's often directed at me, but
no.
But that's okay. It's a good line.
Yeah, it's such a heavily quotable show. Friends of mine and I have said we could communicate solely with Simpsons quotes just from the first 10 or 12 years. Here's another quick one. Kent Brockman, one of my favorites, the newscaster, reporting from Camp Krusty.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've been to Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq, and I can say without hyperbole that this is a million times worse than all of them put together.
Sam Simon, creator of The Simpsons, passed away yesterday at the age of 59.